Hello, everybody. Eli Smith here from the Brooklyn Folk Festival. We got a great festival coming up for you April 6th, 7th, and 8th at St. Anne's Church in Brooklyn Heights. It's the 10th annual Brooklyn Folk Festival, featuring more than 40 different bands, workshops, film screenings, contests, and jam sessions. Check out brooklynfolkfest.com for all the information and for tickets. We hope we'll see you there.
You're tuned to Hi-Fi, WBAI 99.5 on your FM dial, New York.
Pencil.
Okay, this is Joe Franklin broadcasting on radio station WBAI.
It's 99.5% all natural and preservative free. WBAI FM in New York.
I love this radio station.
There was an article in Scientific American that said that men who are insecure in their masculinity will go out of their way to not recycle and think of ecological issues as effeminate. Who gets to decide nonsense like that? I'll have a discussion on that on the April 10th episode of Ecologic, led by clinical psychologist and environmental activist Susan Spieler. It's Tuesday, April 10th, 8 p.m. here on WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Action here on listener-supported community radio, WBAI in New York. I'm Mark Hannay, Director of Metro New York Healthcare for All, and a member of the Health Action Collective that brings you this program every week, along with Catherine Davis and Bob Lederer. In the first interview segment of today's program, we're going to be taking a look at the sale of the nonprofit insurance company here in New York known as Fidelis Care to a national for-profit insurance company, Centene. What it means for New Yorkers and particularly for people in the plan, and there's been a large sort of negotiation around it as part of the recently done state budget in Albany. So we'll hear reports on that. And in the second segment of today's program, Bob Lederer will be here. He'll discuss yet another case of grossly inadequate health care provided to a political activist who's imprisoned here in New York State. He will interview Ann Lamb, co-chair of the New York City chapter of the Jericho Movement for Amnesty and Freedom for U.S. Political Prisoners. It'll be about the case of Robert Seth Hayes, a 70-year-old former Black Panther who's now been imprisoned for 45 years and is currently suffering from several chronic conditions, including dangerously uncontrolled diabetes. So stay tuned for that. But first, we'll start with the Health Action News for this week, taken from stories posted to KaiserHealthNews.org. Politico reports that Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, the lead Democrat on the Senate's Veterans Affairs Committee, says he won't yet commit to supporting President Trump's new pick to lead the Department of Veterans Affairs, Rear Admiral Rodney Johnson. In an interview on CBS's Face the Nation, Senator Sanders noted that Dr. Jackson, President Trump's personal physician, is a virtual unknown on veterans issues. He also expressed concerns that the Trump administration is pushing to privatize nearly $200 billion VA bureaucracy, citing the conservative agenda of the influential donors Charles and David Koch. Trump replaced now former VA Secretary David Shulkin last week after months of criticism over reports that he misused government travel. Shulkin has since said he was forced out for pushing back against efforts to privatize veteran services. Jackson's nomination came as a surprise, and the pick has raised questions about his qualifications to manage the myriad health services and benefit programs provided through the VA, and whether the Trump administration is indeed pressing to privatize more of the agency's services. While he helped negotiate additional funding for the veterans to receive private medical care, Senator Sanders, a former Senate Veterans Affairs Committee chairman, has said beefing up the VA budget and health services should be the priority. In his CBS interview, Sanders said, quote, I do believe the Trump administration, no matter what they are now saying, I think they are working on behalf of the Koch brothers. They want to privatize everything. They've been putting more and more money into private sector with VA money. I do not believe them on that issue. I think they are listening to the Koch brothers, and I think that is a very, very bad idea. The VA does a lot of good things. It has problems. We've got to improve the VA, but I think we've got to listen to the veterans of this country and not privatize it, close quote. Reuters reports that the U.S. retailer Walmart is in early stage talks with health insurer Humana about developing closer ties, with the possible acquisition of Humana being discussed. Should the talks lead to a purchase of Humana by Walmart, it would be the latest deal to bring together a retail chain and a health insurer that's emerged in recent months, following CVS Health Corp's $69 billion deal to buy Aetna and Cigna's $54 billion deal to buy Express Scripts. Walmart and Humana have market capitalizations of $264 billion and $37 billion, respectively. An acquisition of Humana would represent a significant strategic shift for Walmart, which is the world's largest retailer and has primarily been focused on fending off Amazon.com in online shopping. Amazon has also been looking at entering the healthcare sector. Earlier this year, it, along with Berkshire Hathaway and JPMorgan Chase, said they would form a company aimed at cutting healthcare costs for their U.S. employees. Walmart currently has a co-branded Medicare drug plan with Humana that steers patients to Walmart stores. The partnership offers a prescription drug plan that can save up to 20% in drug costs for customers should they use Walmart. Closer ties between the two companies would allow Walmart to tap into Humana's patient population, expanding low-level medical services in its pharmacies to help people avoid emergency room visits. They could also allow it to better manage prescription drug use through access to medical records. Humana's biggest line of business is in managing Medicare Advantage plans for older and disabled people who are on Medicare, a heavily regulated business that Walmart would have to take on in an acquisition. Memberships in Humana's direct sale Medicare Advantage plans rose about 1% to nearly 3 million people as of last year. The company's employer or other group-based Medicare Advantage membership climbed 24% to nearly 450,000 patients. And finally, the AIDS epidemic in the United States could be ended in the next few years, according to the new director of the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Last week, he predicted that, saying that health officials have all the tools they need to prevent the spread of the disease. Dr. Robert Redfield, a former AIDS researcher who spent decades treating people infected with HIV, made his remarks in an all-staff meeting on a second day at the Atlanta-based agency. Despite decades of work, an effective HIV vaccine remains an elusive target. However, Dr. Redfield, who worked in the late 80s and 90s on an experimental HIV vaccine that did not prove to be effective, said that the existing tools for treating HIV and preventing its spread are adequate to stop the epidemic in the U.S. Those tools include use of condoms, but also much broader use of antiviral drugs that can prevent infection by people at risk of contracting the virus. Dr. Redfield choked up at several points during his roughly 45-minute remarks, which were delivered in the form of an interview with the CDC's Associate Director of Communications, who posed questions that had been submitted. Those questions did not include a number of controversial matters, including whether Dr. Redfield will advocate for the lifting of a congressional ban that prevents the CDC scientists from doing research into gun violence. Still, Dr. Redfield hit a number of points that will have earned him favor with the new workforce, including mentioning his strong support for vaccines and for the importance of making policy that's based on scientific evidence. Dr. Redfield also called the devastating opioid epidemic the public health crisis of our time and pledged that the CDC would play a key role, along with other agencies within the Department of Health and Human Services, in addressing the epidemic. He also called emergency preparedness, that is protecting the health of the American public from what they don't expect, the agency's most important mission, whether those threats are pandemic influenza or a new or re-emerging infectious disease threat or bioterrorism or a natural disaster. Dr. Redfield said that the CDC must be 100% prepared. And that's the Health Action News for this week. We'll be back with our first interview segment, taking a look at the sale of the nonprofit Fidelis Care Health Plan to the for-profit Centene Corporation that's taking place here in New York and how it relates to the just-completed New York State budget negotiations. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Health Action. I'm Mark Hannay. In our first half of the program today, we're going to be taking a look at the proposed sale of the nonprofit healthcare plan known as Fidelis Care to a for-profit company, national company known as Centene, here in New York, and what it will mean for people who have coverage through Fidelis Care. It's one of the largest insurance companies here in New York. Joining us is Chuck Bell, who's program director with Consumers Union, and Laura Castle, coordinator with Medicaid Matters New York. Welcome back to Health Action, Chuck and Laura.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
Hi. So let's maybe get started, Chuck, with you with a little bit of background. This is not the first time we've seen this movie, as it were, here in New York. Its roots go back almost 15, 20 years. So let's describe a little bit of that because it really does set a precedent for the current situation with the sale of Fidelis.
Yeah, so around the country, there have been nonprofit hospitals and health plans that have decided to convert to for-profit purposes. And in New York State, the biggest example we've had of this was when Empire Blue Cross Blue Shield became a for-profit company in 2002. And that transaction was valued at about $5 billion. And it generated, you know, a fair amount of debate and controversy about how we want to organize our health plans, whether we might be better off to keep them nonprofits. But generally speaking, if a health plan does go for profit, it has to pay back the full value of the transaction to the public. And the way that that's usually done is to transfer 100% of the assets to a nonprofit charitable foundation, because nonprofit health plans are in the nonprofit sector. And so in most other states where this has happened, that's been the dominant method. But here in New York State, the state itself, government of New York State, took 95% of the value of Empire Blue Cross and used it to fund state health programs over the next 4 to 5 years. We did create a small foundation, the New York State Health Foundation, with approximately $300 million in that deal. So that's sort of the precedent for what has happened with Fidelis Care, the transaction we're talking about today.
Right, and then there was a next attempt at something like this that happened with, well, it was attempted, I guess I should say, it never really came to fruition, with GHI and HIP, which later formed to become Emblem Health. And that was about 10 years ago. What happened in that circumstance?
Yeah. So as many people may know, especially for municipal and public employees, many of them are insured by HIP and GHI, which merged to form Emblem Health in around 2006, 2007. And at that time, Emblem Health was also discussing becoming a for-profit company, and it later decided to withdraw its application in 2008. And in the background of all this is there's a lot of politics by interest groups. So, for example, with the Empire Blue Cross deal, Greater New York Hospital Association teamed up with SEIU 1199 to help lobby for the state to take the money from that deal. And they largely succeeded almost entirely. With Emblem Health, there were other municipal unions involved that also thought that they should be entitled to a share of the money. Both municipal unions, New York State teachers, the healthcare, the hospitals and healthcare unions wanted about a third of the money, and also Mayor Michael Bloomberg wanted a third of the money. So there was a lot of contention over who would get the proceeds from that deal, but ultimately it didn't happen. So on the other side of things are consumer groups like our groups, like Healthcare for All New York and Medicaid Matters and New Yorkers for Accessible Health Coverage and Consumers Union. We have generally argued that this funding needs to be protected and remain in the nonprofit sector, or if it's taken by government, should be used for some important long-term purpose, like expanding health insurance coverage, because that is the mission of having a nonprofit health plan to begin with, is to extend coverage to as many people as possible at the lowest and most affordable rates and make sure it's broadly accessible. And so that's what we have prioritized to be done with the money, but we have largely been sidelined in this latest deal.
Right. So, Laura, turning to you, Fidelis Care historically has been one of the biggest providers of Medicaid coverage across the state. Tell us a little bit about Fidelis Care per se.
Sure. So Fidelis Care provides Medicaid coverage across all counties, including New York City. It, as you said, is one of the largest providers of Medicaid coverage the state has ever had, and as such has been has played a very important role in making sure that New Yorkers across the state are provided with health coverage. So they are a Medicaid managed care plan run by the Catholic Diocese of Brooklyn. And they have a long history of providing mission-driven health coverage. We as healthcare advocates have been critical, as we are of all coverage issues and all health plans. We have been critical of Fidelis in the past because, you know, no health plan is perfect. And there have been instances where we've seen perhaps in the area, for instance, of long-term care, where we haven't necessarily been as pleased with the coverage that they provide. And there are other quality indicators that Fidelis has not always hit. But for the most part, you know, having a statewide, mission-driven, not-for-profit plan that provides Medicaid coverage has been beneficial to New Yorkers.
And there's also been a history of contention with advocates concerning Fidelis around access to reproductive health care services. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. As Fidelis is a health plan that is run by the diocese, it has meant that it is required that Fidelis abide by the diocese religious directives. And so that has meant that Fidelis does not directly provide reproductive health coverage, including coverage of prescription contraception, contraceptives. So that has been problematic. The way that has been handled is people can use essentially an insurance rider to gain access to the services that they need outside of being provided the services directly through Fidelis.
And how's that worked for people?
As far as I know, it has gone smoothly, but it took a long time to iron out something that would work for people. It's been several years that mechanism has been in place. And it took a great deal of advocacy to make sure there was a process that would be as seamless as possible. It is certainly not ideal. We would prefer that people not have to jump through hoops to get the services they're entitled to. And so it has not been a preferable scenario. As far as I know, however, there have been minimal problems with the coverage.
And staying with you, Laura, and Chuck, you can chime in here too. What do we know about this for-profit company, Centene? It's a national insurer. What do we know about that? The one that wants to buy Fidelis.
Right. So Centene is a very large for-profit national company. It provides a great deal of insurance coverage in the public sphere, public insurance coverage. And in some instances, Centene has been the company that has gone into states where the state has not taken up Obamacare on its own, and has set up health insurance exchanges or, you know, online marketplaces where the state has not done that on their own. And so they, in some ways, have a good track record for providing public coverage and, in essence, stepping in where states haven't. But they also, in more recent instances, have been met with some criticism as well.
Chuck, you were starting to say something?
Yes. Yeah, so just to add that Centene is a large and growing company. They have prioritized participation in public programs such as Medicare and state exchange programs. So they're a little bit different than some of the larger commercial companies we're familiar with, like Aetna and Cigna. But they are a for-profit insurance company that's publicly traded on Wall Street. So their objective is really to earn as much money as possible for their investors.
So this sale was announced by the diocese, potential sale still, last fall, and various stakeholders and policymakers began to get in motion with regard to it. From the government level, Chuck, what's supposed to happen in these circumstances?
Well, generally we have procedures in New York State to provide for sales of assets by nonprofit healthcare corporations under the supervision of the New York State Supreme Court and the Attorney General. So if the government had done nothing here, the transaction would have been overseen by Attorney General Eric Schneiderman, and he would have made sure that 100% of the value of the plan went to a suitable nonprofit foundation. Fidelis Care had proposed that 100% of its assets be transferred to a new charitable foundation that would focus on issues relating to social determinants of health, so to try to get at some of the appalling gaps and inequalities that we have in healthcare outcomes here in New York State, particularly for vulnerable populations and patients of color. So the state sort of got involved and staked a claim to up to 90% of the assets as part of the budget process. So legislation was proposed by the governor and also by the assembly to take the lion's share of Fidelis Care's assets and put it in the state treasury. Over time, I guess from what we see today, is that Fidelis Care and the state worked out an accommodation where the state would agree to take $2 billion of the assets and use it for state-funded healthcare programs, and that Fidelis Care would create a new foundation with the remaining $3.2 billion. So it looks like that's what would happen. We are reading for the first time this week what the purposes of the state's taking would be used to fund, and it looks like it would be funding capital projects, perhaps mergers and acquisitions of hospitals to create financially sustainable systems of care. And there's like language that is appearing in the budget for the first time to suggest that a lot of this is going to be going toward hospital-oriented expenses, including transitional funding, operating support in some cases to hospitals. So I think many of us who work on healthcare advocacy in the state, we feel that there should be a more balanced approach to the use of these assets, and that providing support to consumers to get enrolled in healthcare coverage, for example, would be one of our priorities. The mission of a nonprofit health plan is to provide health insurance coverage in the first place, and to make sure that patients have access to the full range of emergency and non-emergency care. So it's not to say that hospitals aren't an incredibly important part of the healthcare system, along with hospital and healthcare workers, but the secretive process that was used to engineer this deal raises concerns about how the money will ultimately be spent and how accountable it will be to the public.
So, Laura, Chuck sort of jumped to the current day, but let's go back to the fall. At that point, some consumer organizations, including yours, started to talk about how they would try to assert the consumer perspective in the state's process around what would happen with the assets of Fidelis if and as it is sold to Centene. Talk a little bit about what happened there.
Sure. So, you know, when we first heard of this in the fall, our first question and perhaps the biggest concern that emerged at the outset was about what would happen to the people who are currently covered by Fidelis in New York State. So that really became our biggest question. What will it mean, for instance, for consumers who are currently covered? Will there be notice to them? What will that look like? What will it mean to be covered by, to go from being covered by a state-run, not-for-profit, mission-driven health plan to being covered by a very large, for-profit, not New York State-based health plan? And so our concerns really at the outset were about what type of impact the sale would have on people currently covered by Fidelis. But we also raised concerns and questions about the process itself. We believe that this type of process must be done with comprehensive and extensive oversight by the state. As Chuck mentioned, this is the role of the Attorney General's office, with additional oversight by the Department of Health and the Department of Financial Services in the state. You know, Fidelis being a statewide plan, we believe there ought to be, for instance, public input, the opportunity for public input from across the state, as much oversight and review as possible to ensure that this conversion is in the public interest as much as it possibly can be.
And there was a consumer advocacy statement that the various organizations kind of put out at about a month or so ago when this budget negotiations really started to heat up. What was the reaction of policymakers to that statement? Laura?
Well, we in many cases were met with many more questions. We were very glad that legislators and staff had an interest in this and had as many questions as they had. I think they like others had taken this the notion of this sale sort of at face value, if you will. As we raised critical concerns and questions about the transaction itself and the impact on consumers, they were intrigued by what we had to say, and many were able to raise some similar concerns as this became a more public debate.
And in particular, this became the debate around the budget in terms of specifically a proposal from the governor to set up what's called the healthcare shortfall fund. Laura, what is that?
Well, the governor, in his budget address, announced that he, perhaps if I remember correctly, even in his State of the State address, announced that he was interested in creating this healthcare shortfall fund, as he called it, essentially to allow the state to have reserves for instances where the federal government might attempt to provide less reimbursement to the state for Medicaid and other health programs. You know, states rely very heavily on federal funding to run the Medicaid program and other and other safety net programs, including funding for critical access hospitals and the like. And so the governor was fearful that with threats that we've heard about at the federal level, there might be a need for reserve funds, so to speak, at the state level to be able to take that impact should we see it. So, as I said, there was a proposal to create this shortfall fund. We raised some concerns about that because while we do recognize the threats from the federal level as far as potential impact here in New York State and the potential for the loss of hundreds of millions of dollars at the state level. We see the need for public funds to be allocated in transparent and accountable ways and not through government slush funds.
So, Chuck, the deal has been cooked, as it were, under the state budget deal just announced. The diocese is keeping some of the money to set up its foundation. The state is taking some of its some of the assets of the sale to fund this healthcare shortfall fund. What comes next for consumer advocates?
Well, in some degree, we're jumping the gun a little bit to say that the state will even get this $2 billion because the deal does require regulatory approval by the New York State Department of Financial Services and the Attorney General and the Department of Health. So I think we can expect that there will be a regulatory review period over the next 2 or 3 months. I think Centene has expressed interest in getting the deal completed by July, so it might be sort of a fast-track process. But nevertheless, I mean, our initial concern of the consumer and community groups going into this is we don't think that conversion of Fidelis Care is necessarily in the public interest, and we need to make sure that we've done our due diligence here to see what are the implications for patients of having a large for-profit insurance company take over our large statewide healthcare plan. So there should be public hearings that would be taking place where patients and consumer groups could have an opportunity to express concerns. I mean, one of the things you're likely to see is under for-profit operation, this health insurance plan will take on a much more commercial character, and it will emphasize issues related to profitability much more so than Fidelis Care has traditionally done. And we will have to go head-to-head with them as they argue to the state that they should be able to raise health insurance rates. So it's not really a benefit for consumer groups to have more for-profit health insurance companies, but we have to do the best we can in terms of extracting whatever commitments and protections we can for the community, recognizing that there's a lot of pressure to put this thing through. So I think it's still not a done deal. There have been nonprofit health plans that have actually withdrawn their conversion plans in five other instances that I know of. One was Emblem Health, and then Blue Cross plans in five other states also withdrew their health conversion proposals after public comment and review. So it's not necessarily a done deal, even though it looks like it's sort of wired in. You know, there's still some opportunity for the public to be heard on this issue.
And Laura, quickly, in our last 30 seconds or so, for people who currently have their coverage through Fidelis, do they have anything to worry about in the immediate moment?
No, we don't believe that people should be alarmed about this. The concerns that we have raised as consumer advocates are structural and long-term, and the Centene Corporation has indicated they don't have any interest in upsetting the apple cart as it relates to consumer access to coverage and needed services. So in the immediate future, the answer is no. People who are currently covered by Fidelis should not be immediately concerned. Again, we do have long-range concerns about what this will mean for people, but people should generally not be alarmed at this moment.
And they'll still have access to all the doctors and hospitals currently in the network, correct?
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, good. Thank you. We've been getting a bit of a primer here on what's going on with Fidelis Care. It's proposed to be sold by the Catholic Diocese to a for-profit company called Centene, and there's provisions about how that should happen in the just-announced state budget deal between the governor and the legislature. Joining us to help sort all that out has been Chuck Bell, Programs Director with Consumers Union, and Laura Castle, Coordinator with Medicaid Matters New York. Thanks for joining us here on Health Action, Chuck and Laura.
Thank you, Mark.
And
Thank
we'll
you.
Be back with
Thanks.
Our second segment with Bob Lederer in a moment. Thanks to Reggie Johnson for engineering this part of the program. I'm Mark Hannay.
This is Bob Lederer for Health Action. This segment is another in our continuing series on the prison system's medical mistreatment of aging people who have been long incarcerated for their political actions. This, of course, is just another subset of the larger medical neglect of incarcerated people in general. Robert Seth Hayes is one of the longest-held political prisoners in the United States. In the 1960s, Seth Hayes was active in the New York Black Panther Party and was later imprisoned for his involvement in the struggle for black liberation, convicted of killing a police officer in 1973. Seth was sentenced to 25 years to life, which means after serving 25 years, he was eligible for parole. Seth has now been locked in New York State prisons for 45 years and unjustly denied parole on 10 occasions. While in prison, Seth has participated in programs with the NAACP and the JCs and has worked as a librarian, pre-release advisor, and AIDS counselor. Whenever possible, he's taken college courses. In short, Seth is a model prisoner and meets all criteria for release, yet has been repetitively denied parole for no other reason than, quote, the serious nature of the crime, unquote. This essentially means that the parole board has taken it on itself to resentence Seth to life in prison. Seth is currently challenging this violation of his constitutional rights in federal court and will be going before the parole board for the 11th time in June. Seth Hayes turns 70 this year and for the past 20 years has been struggling with several chronic medical conditions, including hepatitis C, which he finally was able to get cured after a long struggle, and diabetes and congestive heart failure. Seth experiences regular and routine code blue health crises where his blood sugars and insulin levels are not manageable and have resulted in him passing out and falling. He's now experiencing nerve damage as well. He's had great difficulty procuring necessary health care and has needed the help of his lawyers and community activists as well as some state political leaders in order to get minimal treatment that he has sporadically received. According to a recent appeal for support from Seth's daughter and granddaughter, Maisha and Crystal Hayes, quote, Seth is one of 10,000 people in the New York State prison system over the age of 50 who pose little to no risk at all for recidivism. His continued incarceration is very much a risk to his life, as his diabetes cannot be effectively treated inside, and he needs to be with his family and the community that loves him. And with us to discuss Seth Hayes' situation is Ann Lamb, co-chair of the New York chapter of the Jericho Movement for Amnesty and Freedom for U.S. Political Prisoners. And thanks for joining us. And you've been visiting Seth for many years, actually. So tell us about how he's currently doing and the current status, as you understand it, of the quality of medical care he's receiving.
Okay. Just saw Seth on Friday. He called me Thursday evening. It's in the infirmary. Now, most people's blood sugar levels, just so people know, sort of run in between like 85 to 110, and that's like a normal blood level. So when you have diabetes, it tends to either go up or down and fluctuate a lot. So talking to Seth on the phone, and he's telling me that his sugars are up above 700. Now, this is considered above diabetic coma range, and I could tell by his voice that he sounded awful. So my friend Dan Jaffe, who also works with us in New York City, Jericho, and I went up on Friday, had the day off, and we went to see Jalil and Seth. So I really wanted to see Seth, of course, because I know, you know, how urgent this is. And this has been like an ongoing situation that started about a month ago with this whole thing. He had the insulin pump and the monitor and the sensors, and that was not working correctly, and they weren't really doing anything about it. So it was inevitable that he would have yet another crisis. You know, it was definitely inevitable that this would happen. So I was very upset to get that call, but I was not surprised. This has been an ongoing pattern. Every time we get something that works well for Seth, he'll be doing well for a few weeks, and then suddenly medical personnel does something, and then nothing works anymore. So, you know, it's a consistent pattern. I can't say I have proof that it's deliberate, but it certainly seems to be deliberate. I can't imagine anything else. So Seth is currently in the so-called infirmary, which is like a giant shoe. SHU is like the hole. This is where they put you in solitary confinement. Special housing unit, they call it SHU. So it's like that down there because the COs are running the show. the so-called patients are not getting medical treatment. They have, I've seen the space, I've been there. They have beds for about 16 people. They have a couple of actual isolation cells in there for people who are in SHU, and they put them in the SHU, even though they're ill. They keep it either very hot or very cold at all times. And the COs make medical decisions. Like, for instance, if you get a shot of insulin, you are supposed to eat within half an hour. So they will give Seth a shot of insulin and then not bring him any food, which will cause his sugar levels to drop drastically. So this is really, for the millionth time, as I say, 20 years we've been trying to save Seth's life. So this is another time that we really need to have people call and make sure to demand that Robert Seth Hayes, number 74A, 2280, be taken on an emergency basis to Albany Medical Center to see the endocrinologist, who is that's the endocrinologist he's been seeing for a long time. He was at Coxsackie, now he's at Albany Medical Center, and to get adequate medical care. Because for his sugar to fluctuate in one day from a low of 62 in the morning to a high of almost 600 in the evening, and he called me today, and that's what's been going on today, is really unconscionable. And it goes also to prove they kept him in the infirmary because they wanted to make sure he wasn't eating anything that he shouldn't be eating, et cetera, et cetera. So he only has available to him the food that they are giving him. There is no diabetic diet in the New York State prison system. They have what they call a Class B diet. It is not a good diet for diabetics. Diabetics should have a lot of fresh greens. They should eat fresh vegetables. They should eat whole grains. He's being given white pasta, white potatoes, white rice, you know, beets. So if your sugars are high, you shouldn't be eating something that sugar is made from. And, you know, the food, the quality of the food is awful. I have seen it, and I would not feed it to anybody. So, you know, this is what's going on at the moment, and it's very important that people make this call.
And we're going to give out information in a few minutes about how people can make their voices heard to the prison authorities. But I want to just talk a little more about the diet situation, because part of the way that some incarcerated people can have a little bit of support for a better diet is that New York State does allow family and supporters to bring in fresh food, although that was recently challenged and they tried to take that away and there was a huge community fight back, and that was for the time being protected. But in any case, tell us a little about how you and other supporters of Seth Hayes have been able to support him by bringing in food.
Well, that's a really important point, Bob, because that's really life-saving for Seth. He's currently at Sullivan. He's been at Sullivan since 2011. So at Sullivan, it's not what they say. It's not a TV facility, meaning you don't have a TV in your cell. So every person there can get 35 pounds of food a month, or a food package. It doesn't have to just be food. In Seth's case, it usually is mostly food. So we'll make sure that we bring him, you know, whole grain bread. We'll bring him some things he can get in commissary, like grits and all, and other things he can't. We'll make sure he has plain oatmeal. We'll make sure he has fresh greens. We'll make sure he has also some canned greens without any salt, because he also has high blood pressure. So, you know, this is a constant thing, and it really is life-saving for Seth and other people in his situation, because as Seth always says, I am not the only one. This is not about me. This is about all diabetics in the New York State prison system. Nobody gets a diabetic diet. I would hope somebody like the American Diabetes Association or some other organization that does work around diabetics would really pressure Carl Konigsman, the chief medical officer, to implement a diabetic diet. They have a kosher diet. And they have this Class B diet, which they give to everybody who has diabetes, and it's just absolutely the wrong food. And the proof is, here's Seth's sugars this morning, 62, little low, but not alarmingly so. And they gave him for breakfast waffles with syrup on it, syrup already on it. And then at lunchtime, his sugars were already up over 400, and now they're up to almost 6. So it's clearly proving that their food does not work for diabetics.
Now, Ann Lamb, New York State law allows people incarcerated to seek medical parole. And That's defined as something eligible for individuals who are either terminally ill or have conditions that debilitate them and cannot be treated effectively in the context of a prison. Now, Seth applied for medical parole, and that was rejected by the Department of Corrections. And tell us a little more about what were the grounds of his application, since I assume that the Corrections Department is saying, well, we have fine medical care and diabetes is not outside of our expertise, so there's no problem. He doesn't need to be released for that purpose.
Well, we haven't seen all the paperwork yet. We, you know, Eve Rosan got a verbal from DOCS. DOCS is a New York State Department of Corrections and Community Supervision because they merged the parole with the DOC. So, of course, all that paperwork went in, you know, his medical records, the sugar fluctuations, you know, especially in this past period, have been really bad. And this is an internal DOCS thing. You still end up going to the board. Like if they would have said, yes, you're eligible, he still goes to the parole board. The parole board decides. So Dr. Wolf, who is the facility doctor at Sullivan, she could have easily said, I am recommending him to not be here because we clearly cannot control his sugars. I don't think she said that. We don't know yet, as I say. I don't have the, you know, the paperwork yet. But I'm sure that if the facility doctor had recommended that he go forward with this process, it probably would have happened, and he would have not have been told he's not eligible because he is medically eligible completely. So I would assume that that is probably what happened. And as soon as we get the paperwork, we'll put it up on jerichony.org so people can read it and see exactly what they said.
All right, so now tell us exactly what you recommend that people who want to make sure that Seth Hayes gets proper medical care, at least as long as he is going to remain there. And, of course, again, he will be applying for the 11th time in June for parole from the New York State Parole Board. But in the meantime, he needs to have absolutely state-of-the-art medical care. And so what can people do in our audience to lend their voices to that effort?
I would hope that everybody will lend their voice to this effort. This is really a matter of life and death. I kid you not. The man is going to be 70 years old. This has been going on for 20 years. He is extremely weak and debilitated. When he came into the visiting room yesterday, he could hardly walk. He could not stand up. He was sitting in his chair, and he said, I can't stand up to hug you. And I said, well, please don't. I don't want you to stand up to hug me. I don't want you to fall down, which has also been happening a lot because of the nerve damage. I want everybody who is listening to this, do this thing tomorrow. Call Jay Konigsman, M.D. He is the chief medical officer for the Division of Health Services, and his phone number is 518-457-7073. That's 518-457-7073. And you can also go to jerichony.org. This is right on our first page. You don't have to look for it. And you can read a little bit more detail about what's been happening with Seth. And you can also, there's also another number you can call if you're so inclined. And I would really appreciate it. Seth is already thanking people who were making phone calls yesterday. They were calling throughout the day while we were there. And you could see that they were being very vigilant to make sure, you know, he was okay while we were there. But, of course, as soon as we left, then things started to happen bad.
And just to clarify, Dr. Konigsberg is with the health division, but that's the division of the Department of Corrections and Community Supervision. So he's part of the state prison system who's responsible for providing acceptable medical care.
Oh, I forgot to say, when you call Dr. Konigsman's office, you cannot just refer to Robert Seth Hayes. You must say, I am calling about Robert Seth Hayes, number 74A2280. That's 74A2280. And I am demanding that he be taken to Albany Medical Center on an emergency basis to see the endocrinologist and the medical team at Albany Medical Center that know exactly how to properly calibrate his insulin pump, monitor, and sensor.
Okay. And again, that is the doctor who's responsible for the medical supervision of incarcerated people throughout the state system. All right. Well, we also want to just briefly touch on another case of another political prisoner, and that's someone who's also 70 years old, former Black Panther. His name is Herman Bell. He's been held, like Robert Seth Hayes, in New York State prisons for 45 years, also convicted of killing police officers. And last month, acting on Herman Bell's eighth application, the New York State Parole Board finally granted him parole and set his release date for April 17th. And again, like Seth, Herman has an exemplary record in prison of service to others and his own self-development, and the decision by the board reflects a long-fought-for appointment of new commissioners and new regulations that base release decisions more on who a person is today and their accomplishments while in prison than on the nature of their original crime. The Patrolman's Benevolent Association, however, has mounted a furious attack on the parole board for this decision, and that attack has been supported by Governor Cuomo and Mayor de Blasio. They're all attempting to get the parole board to reconsider its decision in Herman's case. In response, over 100 criminal justice and civil rights organizations have signed a statement in support of the parole board's decision, and also a group of artists and cultural workers have their own statement. So, Anne, as we close out, just tell us, how can listeners weigh in support of parole, the decision that's been made properly through the parole guidelines for 70-year-old Herman Bell?
Okay, well, very briefly, what people can do is call Governor Cuomo's office. Governor Cuomo is actually, in coming out against this decision, is, as Charles Barron said at the press conference, he should be charged with obstruction of justice, and I wish he would be. But people should call our national co-chair, Jihad. He called and he spoke the other day. He said he was on the phone with them for 15 minutes. They are paying attention. And that number is 518-474-8390. Once again, 518-474-8390. We're also up on the first page of jerichony.org, so you can find both campaigns in the same place. And this is really amazing to see this backlash. We know of the visceral hatred that the police have for anybody who is a Black Panther or a Black Liberation Army member, whether they actually killed a police officer or not. The same hatred that they have for Mumia Abu-Jamal, they have for Robert Seth Hayes, they have for Herman Bell, they have for everybody else who's inside under those circumstances. So this is really, really serious. If we, the people, don't push and show our power, they will probably try to rescind his parole. And that would be a totally illegal thing. It's been done before in other cases, so we know they can do it. So far, they haven't been backing down, but we're all on tenterhooks because we're waiting for April 17th, which Bob Boyle said in the press conference was not necessarily a release date. It was a control date. So, you know, that means they could maybe hold him somewhat longer than that, which we really hope they would not after 45 years. Now, I've been visiting Herman also for many years, and Herman is one of the sweetest, nicest people you would want to meet. Young men walk into the visiting room when Herman is there, and they stop, and they say, "Good afternoon, Mr. Bell." That's because of all the youth he's been mentoring for all these years. He has tremendous respect. And let's not forget that in September, the correctional officers deliberately tried to murder him as well. So, you know, he really needs to come home and be with his wife and his family.
And I want to thank our guest, Anne Lamb, co-chair of the New York chapter of the Jericho Movement for Amnesty and Freedom for U.S. Political Prisoners. And again, their website with lots of information on both the cases we've been discussing, Robert Seth Hayes and Herman Bell and many others, is www.jerichony.org. And before we go, I just want to thank all of our listeners who have given generously to support WBAI, this listener-sponsored, unique media organization that can tell the truth without fear. And I want to urge those of you who are not already BAI buddies to become one today. That's a privilege that's available to anyone who donates $10 a month or more. It'll be painlessly and automatically taken out of your bank account, and you'll know that you'll be giving WBAI a steady stream of basic sustenance to pay the the very high bills that have to be paid to run a radio station in the largest media market in the United States. So please go to our website, which is give2wbai.org. That's give2wbai.org, and sign up to become a BAI buddy. We're making a real push this month to get as many buddies signed up as possible so that we can hopefully shorten the next pledge drive. It's really vital. This is a critical institution to stay alive and to strengthen, and we hope you'll show that support. So that wraps it up for this segment, and I want to thank John Riley for his engineering assistance. And until next time, stay healthy and stay balanced. I'm Bob Lederer.
I'm Jesse Lent with the WBAI Resistance Calendar. Thursday, April 12th at 7 p.m., join activist Cindy Sheehan for a peace rally at the Cinema Arts Center at 423 Park Avenue in Huntington, Long Island. A former congressional candidate and 2012 vice presidential nominee for the Peace and Freedom Party, Sheehan is probably best known for her extended anti-war protest back in 2005 at a makeshift camp she set up 3 miles up the road from President George W. Bush's Texas ranch after her son, U.S. Army Specialist Casey Sheehan, was killed in the Iraq War. You can find out more information by sending an email to Long Island Activists Group at gmail.com, or you can reach the Cinema Arts Center directly at 631-423-7611. And on Sunday, April 22nd at 1 p.m., the organization Revolting Lesbians will hold an Earth Day protest they're calling The Earth Is Not For Sale at the Museum of Natural History on West 77th Street and Central Park West in Manhattan to protest the presence of major Republican donor and co-owner of Breitbart News, Rebecca Mercer, on the museum's board. Rebecca Mercer has bought her way into the White House and onto the Board of Trustees at the Museum of Natural History, reads a statement from organizers. Mercer money is destroying our democracy and our planet. Nobody voted for her, and she has no place on the board of a science museum. We will continue to revolt against Rebecca Mercer's position on the board until she is removed or resigns. To learn more, go to justiceduckling.com and click on the NYC protest events calendar at the top of the page, or you can email the organizers directly at revoltinglesbians@gmail.com. Also happening on that same date and time, Earth Day Sunday, April 22nd at 1 p.m., over 40 community organizations from Westchester will come together at Pace Law School at 78 North Broadway in White Plains, New York, for the Westchester Social Forum. We live in a time of struggle as we witness growing threats to the well-being of our planet and communities as profit is placed over people and land, and corporations, not civilians, control our democracy, reads a statement from organizers. Yet we the people have the collective power to organize a movement for change. Find out more at westchestersocialforum.org, or you can reach Pace Law School directly by calling 914-422-4210. And on Saturday, April 28th at 2 p.m., the May Day Collective is presenting a free outdoor concert in Maria Hernandez Park at 301 Soydom Street in Brooklyn called the May Day Festival of Resistance. Scheduled performers include Nitty Scott, Maku Sound System, and Bushwick Jorico Collective. This year, we lift up the fierce, powerful movements led by women of color, black women, trans women, and femmes who are transforming our world, reads a statement from the May Day Collective about the event. Women around the country and world are fighting patriarchy, working to end community militarization, transforming the political dialogue, challenging the mainstream entertainment industry, and creating global culture through unapologetic intersectional feminism. To get more information about the May Day Festival of Resistance, go to facebook.com/maydayspace and click on events at the side of the page, or send an email to
good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a weekly program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, well, this week, represents the 50th anniversary of the movie 2001: A Space Odyssey. Joining me will be Dan Persons. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. once again, good morning. So, there's a lot to talk about. I have been thinking about, how to deal with the opening, commemorating this for actually more than a year. But I haven't come up with anything particularly special. My number one resource for this would have been, of course, the doc, Paul Wunder. But Paul is, not on somewhere in that astral plane, as is seen in the movie 2001. But he is the single person that I know who I would call absolutely, utterly expert. Now, of course, there's also our movie critic, Dan Persons, who is in Philly and seems to be having Skype problems. Let me try to bring up his sound. Are you there at all, Dan? Can you hear me?
I'm sorry, Dave. I can't comply.
Yeah, okay. So, yeah, you're sounding pretty good there.
Very good. You're sounding okay, too. I was panicking here because during the theme you were cutting in and out, but okay. Sounds okay now.
Okay, yeah, do me a favor. When I'm engineering and trying to set up and log in to Facebook and Google and stuff like that, which is everything I have to do during my theme music alone, bear in mind that's what I'm doing at that moment. So it's...
I'm just a little pest, that's all.
Yeah, pest? Sorry, never mind. so anyway, there are so many places to start, and I'm still not logged into Google, which if I'm going to play any of the music that I wish to play, I'm going to have to do. So just bear with me a moment. But I think that... I am going to start with a statement that for very few people may be slightly incendiary, and I'm going to expect you, Dan, to defend that statement because I don't believe you're going to attack it. And okay. The statement is that 2001, A Space Odyssey, is plain and simple the best science fiction film ever made.
Well, if you wanted an opposing opinion, no, you're not going to get it here. I would agree completely with that. I wanted to point out that it's interesting the way you started in on this conversation because for the past month or so, I myself have been figuring out what I wanted to say during this show and actually have come a cropper myself in trying to form my opinions. And I think the reason for me, and this cues into our shared opinion that this is the greatest science fiction film ever made, was that at the very least for me, this was more than a film. I think people tend to use, and I tend to use, like the phrase, this was a formative event for me. People use that too often. But in this particular case, it is quite true that this goes beyond just being a film. This is something that I saw at a time of life that changed the way I looked at many things, looking at film, looking at science fiction, looking at storytelling. And so
I may point out that it is I'm having problems logging in. I'm going to forget Facebook. I'm into Google. That's good enough. It is a unique film. There was never a film like it before. And while some movies have emulated it or tried to do certain things on it, or many, many refer to it, there has never been an equal.
in many, many ways.
I will say one thing. There are those people that will say, and I can name some of them. For example, they think Blade Runner is better, to which I say rubbish, because I don't even think Blade Runner is that brilliant a film on its own. I prefer the sequel. But the sequel was better thought out, and they knew that they had to live up to a certain something, and I think that Denis Villeneuve is a better director than Ridley Scott. Period.
I wouldn't necessarily argue with that, but you know I had problems with 2049.
There are some issues. There are some problems. It is not a perfect movie. For that matter, 2001 is not a perfect movie, but it still set a mark. But my point about Blade Runner versus 2001 is that I will put dollars to donuts that the people who will say otherwise saw those movies at a certain age. That is to say, I saw 2001 in Cinerama at age 13 at least three times. Mm-hmm. A lot of people, then, when it was re-released in 70 millimeter, a lot of people rediscover it, and that was, you know, it was a bomb at first. It did not do well, and after all, there aren't Cinerama theaters in every major place. The 70 millimeter was getting around, and when it was re-released, what, about 1971 or something like that?
I think it was 73 or 74.
73 was the first number that came into my head, so probably is that. And then they called it the Ultimate Trip.
Yeah.
They were going for the psychedelia rather than for what it was about.
Well, I think the coinage of the phrase "the ultimate trip" came in during the initial release. The way I heard the tale was that the film was bombing. There was some theater manager who one day went into the theater. The theater was empty, except there was a hippie sitting in the front row. And then the next day, the hippie was back, and he had brought two friends with him.
Okay, that's not true. I can tell you about eight reasons why that's not true.
Okay.
Number one, it would have to be in a Cinerama theater.
Mm-hmm.
Now, Cinerama theaters are big, and they don't do screenings without, you know, big. So it's not like it was, what it was is it wasn't making its money back, partly also because Kubrick went over budget and over time. But number two, it was never on a poster saying the ultimate experience until years later. And believe me, that's not because some member of NATO, and that would be the National Association of Theater Owners, came up with it. It was the marketing people, and they came up with it, and those posters are very valuable, and that's the first time it was coined that, years after the movie debuted.
Okay, that may be true. I am...
And I've one advantage over you. I lived through it.
Oh, I lived through it. Well...
Yeah, no, you were,
when you say it, what do, it depends what it means. What is it for you? Because I lived through it, too. Let me give you the perspective.
How old were you when the movie debuted in 1968?
Well,